Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And as Peter said, we're going to start the program today with our recent visit to the party capital of the country, or of the world, or of the universe.
At least for a single day. June 15th, 2013, they have this party called Five Star Sensation. Every 2 years, it takes them so long to plan it. But 2,500 people bought tickets. And they raised over $2.5 million for cancer-related charity, and it all happens
at the University Hospital, and it's called the Five Star Sensation.
Yeah, I said that. And it takes three large tents and a large outdoor cooking organization.
They even had a special tent for pastry chefs.
They did.
This time.
They had that the last time too.
Yeah, well, and it's all orchestrated by such a humanitarian and philanthropist, Wolfgang Puck.
Yeah, he was amazing. He had one of those, he was so busy we didn't even get to talk to him. He had one of those little chain things that they have in front of the TSA things at the airport, in front of his...
Ropes.
They had a whole set of ropes and they were full the whole night. They were full when we left.
I didn't even get to taste any of it.
Yeah.
And it was how many linear feet long, do you suppose?
Well, it was pretty long. I don't know. We got to the party at 5:30 and we were leaving nicely around 10:30, so you can tell we had a good time. But we managed to catch up with a few people along the way.
Now, usually we've introduced, and we've been doing this, is this our fourth trip or fifth?
Fourth, I think.
Fourth. And it's only every two years.
Yep.
But we've interviewed like most of the participating chefs over the years, and we did something fairly unique. This time around. Yeah, we interviewed, and they were in the VIP section, I guess, two guests to see what the guests thought. We certainly know what the chefs think, and we know what we think, and we found two willing attendees.
Absolutely. Mr. and Mrs. Borky, Jared and Wendy. So, Jared and Wendy, thank you again on the air for taking the time to talk to us. We're sure you had a wonderful time. We didn't see you for the rest of the evening, but we're sure you had a great time. And since you have an upcoming happy event, we'll wish you all the best for that, too. But
she
here's
was
our
really
conversation.
Pregs.
yeah, well, as you know, you'll note in the interview.
Pregs.
She looked enormously like Sandra Bullock to me, so...
Yes,
if you
did.
Were doing a Sandra Bullock lookalike, you could say Sandra Bullock's expecting. I doubt she would appreciate us saying that, but we can get away with it because we're on the air and we're in charge. Anyway, here are Jared and Sandy. Oops, Jared and Wendy.
Well, you know, we've always, at the Five Star Sensation, talked to the chefs, talked to the winemakers, talked to everybody. We've never actually asked anybody tending what they think of the event, and most importantly, what they've eaten. We now have two, Jared and Wendy Borky, who are attendees. And I might say to start with that Wendy will not discuss wine because she's pregnant. And in fact, Peter thinks she looks like Sandra Bullock, to give you an idea. And her husband's not bad either. But we're going to say, I'm going to pass you this microphone so that you can actually tell us if you like the event, what you like about it, and also specify things you've eaten or drunk that you like. I saw smiles on your husband's face.
Well, I think this is now probably our fourth or fifth time attending the Five Star, and it's definitely something that we always look forward to, you know, every 2 years, and just being able to sample the different wines that we've been able to, a lot of times we've been able to go back to the valley and go to some of the places that we have tried the wine, so that's been nice. But unfortunately this year, as you were saying, it's my first year being pregnant during this event, so I don't get to taste the wine. But anyways, I definitely am here for some of the food tasting and the pairings. And the one thing I definitely enjoyed was the Green Zebra. Went there, they had a really nice, it was a creamy onion soup. It was very, very smooth and definitely enjoyed that. And then a new place that opened up right down the street here in Ohio, the Moreland Hills, the ML Tavern, got to try the lobster mashed potato, which right before we did this interview, I just had that. So that's definitely still on my mind. It was very, very good as well. Just something different. I don't know if you'd like to.
As far as the wine is concerned, we've only been here just a little bit. I've had a couple of tastings across from us there, the Farniente, and then the Domaine Druin over in Dundee, Oregon. They have a fabulous Pinot Noir that they have. Two of them, actually, but one that was a little more spicy was actually really fabulous Pinot. For those that are more or less wine connoisseurs, they know that that part of the country yields some fabulous Pinots, and that was one of the things we look forward to quite often. Again, as Wendy had mentioned, we look forward to coming to the event every couple of years. There's always some fabulous wineries here and some new tastes, as well as some of the consistent ones from Wolfgang Puck and from Pellegrini and Piero Salvaggio. I mean, they always provide some fabulous fare for us. So we always look forward to both the wine and the food pairings that come from that.
Does it make you proud to be a Clevelander?
Yeah, actually, it does. Having an event like this, I think, is very unique around the country. And being a Clevelander at a night like this, really, really, you could see what Cleveland's made of on a night like this. Actually, since you mentioned that, the Cleveland Browns fair that they have here, they had this chicken potsticker, which was fabulous.
Don't mind my showing this microphone, but you realize we're from Pittsburgh.
So if I go over and eat Cleveland Browns food, I will surely die.
That's not necessarily the case. Pittsburgh happens to be a fabulous town despite the Steelers.
Peter's calling a halt.
And we'll be back with interviews with several of the participating chefs right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and onwards to the meeting, talking to the chefs when they were so busy. I'm telling you, so busy, but they did take the trouble and time to talk to us, and I kept trying to grab food. I have to admit that, you know, I sometimes sound as though I have a mouthful. I probably do. But anyhow, let's start out with one of our most favorite restaurants and chef and restaurateurs is Blackbird in Chicago. And we had Dana Cree from there talking to us. Paul, it's one of Paul Cannon's or Cahan's, depending on how you want to talk to restaurants. And it's exceptionally fun. And listen to what she had to say. Here's Dana. Yeah, well, we seem to be having a run on Chicago right now. But we now have Dana Cree, who is the pastry chef from Blackbird Restaurant, which I adore, and I adore her owner, Paul Kahn, and as I said, we're in Chicago. But Dana, you're here. Is this your first time?
Yes, this is my first time here at this event.
It's a great event, by the way. Tell us what you're serving today, and don't spare the details.
We're serving sort of an ice cream sundae in a snow cone, and we have made an ice cream out of roasted peanuts that we've infused with star anise, basil, and Saigon cinnamon. And on top of that, we're breaking up pieces of a barley and carrot cake. Then there's little tidbits of pineapple that have been poached in a basil syrup, crystallized peanuts, and honeyed whipped cream over the top.
Well, you know, I can't tell you how thrilled I am that finally pastry chefs are getting recognition. Part of it is because most pastry chefs are women. And also the other part is because I think people love desserts more than any other segment of the meal. What do you say about the new recognition?
Well, it's hard for me to know too much. I've only been doing this for 12 years. So I seem to have walked into an environment of recognition built for me by the people like Sherry Yard, who I've worked for and who is such a force to be reckoned with and who has helped elevate desserts to the same level of recognition that savories have. And, I mean, why not? Who doesn't love dessert?
I don't know where she gets her energy. What are you dressed up as?
Well, me and my girls are dressed as carrot farmers today.
Carrot farmers?
Yeah. We in order to hold the snow cones, we fill planter boxes with sugar and plant the carrot cake sundaes in the planter boxes. So we dressed up like little carrot farmer girls.
I just had the most spectacular Sunday of my whole entire life, Corn Sunday at a Peruvian restaurant in London. And we're going to put a photograph on our website. It's the most humongous thing, and I ate every bit of it.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And keep baking, keep composing. It's not even baking now. It's really creative, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me.
We love wines from Oregon. Well, wouldn't you know, the organizers, I think, must have realized that too, because we were stationed right next to a very fine Oregon winery, Domaine Druin, originally French, of course, and we sampled quite a lot of their product during the course of the evening. And Ashley Bell, who's the director of sales and education, I think, took the time to talk to us. As luck would have it, here at Five Star Sensation, behind our table is a whole lot of wine glasses. And next to us on the left is the reason there are a lot of wine glasses behind us, because we're sitting next to Domaine Druin, which is a very unusual Oregonian wine. But I'm talking to Ashley Bell, representing Domaine Druin. Ashley, this is not an Oregon name.
No, the Druin family has been making Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in Burgundy since 1880, and they purchased 100 acres in the Dundee Hills back in 1987.
Now, what possessed them to do that?
They were really impressed by the quality of the fruit and the wine. It was really David Lett, who founded Irie Vineyards in 1966, that caused Robert Druin to purchase 100 acres there, and now they have 225 acres. They really believe in the land and the terroir.
Now, what makes a... Well, you said to me earlier on, this is an Oregon wine made by French people. What is it that you think that makes it different?
Well, Veronique Druin is our winemaker. She's made every drop since our first vintage in 1988, and the Druin style is very hands-off. They want the wines to be very honest. They want the wines to be indicative of the soil, of the weather, of the vintage. So from year to year, the wines are going to be different, and it's taken from a Burgundian perspective with thousands of years of winemaking behind them.
But she's French and a woman.
She is. Her family's been doing this for four generations, and she grew up with wine. She tells these wonderful stories about being 7 years old at the dinner table with her father pouring wine for her and her three brothers and asking them to identify the wines. And now every decision that's made at the winery is decided based upon her palate, how the wine smells and tastes.
So if I go to a wine shop and I see Domaine Druin, and then I see Willa Kenzie, and then I see Rex Hill, and then I see one of these other fine Oregon winemakers, what's going to help me to decide whether I should buy a Domaine Druin or something else?
All the wines that you mentioned are quite lovely, and they have an individual style and personality. And if you want a wine that's very indicative of the place where it was grown, Domaine Druin is a very honest Pinot Noir.
And a little white stuff, too?
A little Chardonnay as well. That's a little bit of a combination between Chablis and Meursault. So it holds a spot that's near and dear to my heart.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We better let you go back to serving all these customers.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It was certainly a pleasure meeting John Dubois, who's the chef de cuisine of Green Zebra, which is, of course, owned by Sean McClain, who's one of my favorite chefs, again, in Chicago. He has a number of restaurants, and in fact, when you listen to our interview with John Dubois, who has worked with Sean for, I think he said, 8 or 9 years, you'll find out some of the activities of Sean and opening new places in Vegas, which is why he wasn't there at the event. Anyhow, let's listen and get all the soup, what am I trying to say, all the scoop on what's going on in that empire. One of my most favorite heirloom tomatoes is Green Zebra, of all things. And here we have a chance to interview the chef de cuisine, John Dubois. Is that the French pronunciation? We know Sean McClain, who's the owner of the whole group of restaurants, but I've never been to Green Zebra. What would I expect? Tell me, what is Green Zebra?
Green Zebra is a restaurant, vegetable-focused restaurant in Chicago, vegetarian for lack of a better word, where we use vegetables as the star of each dish. Most other restaurants, you know, kind of hide the vegetables underneath a piece of fish or a piece of beef. We want to bring that hidden vegetable to the forefront of the dish, make it a star. We create food for not only vegetarians and vegans, but we do have a lot of carnivores and meat eaters that come in, and the best compliment they could give us is, I didn't miss the meat, which, you know, means we're doing our jobs right.
Well, you know, this is right on trend. There's so many people eating vegetable-focused food now that are not vegetarians. Is this your first time at this five-star sensation?
This is my first time with Green Zebra. I was here a few years ago with Sean McClain, the owner, with his other restaurant, Spring, and he asked me to go this year because he is unfortunately unable to prior business obligations out in Las Vegas, and I'm happy to be here for a second time. The event's bigger and better, and, you know, it's for a great cause, close to my heart especially, so I'm happy to help out.
Now, our listeners always like a bit of a verbal food porn. Could you describe one or two dishes in detail?
Well, tonight we are serving a creamy Vidalia onion soup with melted spring onions and a black truffle whipped creme fraiche. And our other dish, we have a chilled roasted shiitake mushroom and asparagus salad with a saffron aioli and a savory almond granola.
I want that now. I'm so hungry. John, it was wonderful talking to you and good to see you. And say hello to Sean for us.
We will. Thanks again for having me.
Have a good evening here.
You too.
John, since Sean McClain is not here to talk about these new restaurants in Vegas, could you explain the concepts of those?
You said he has two restaurants in Las Vegas. The first one he opened about 3 years ago. It's called Sage, and it's really like artisan meat, carefully prepared, a lot of French technique, more of a high-end style restaurant, a very kind of like Sean McClain on a plate. A lot of his flavors and flavor combinations and pieces of produce that he uses at his other restaurants that I've had to work at previous years. So it's kind of like a combination of the restaurants that he had in Chicago in Las Vegas. The second one that he just opened up yesterday is called 550. That refers to the temperature at which the ovens are at, because they are doing like artisan flatbreads, artisan pizzas, bar, more casual place where people can come grab a bite to eat, maybe, you know, watch something on the television. But instead of having your typical bar fare, just a little bit more polished, a little bit fancier of ingredient, but still super casual. So if you want to kick back and relax, do that. And if you want to have more of a experience, you can head up the stairs to Sage and eat there.
Sounds good to me. You know, I mean, we weren't just fixated on Chicago, though it sounds like it. We talked to some of our friends from other cities. But it's just a matter of logistics, and it was getting, as you can hear, fairly loud, but we just call it vivacious or what else?
What else you might call it?
Yeah. But anyhow, Mindy Siegel, who's our next guest, is also from Chicago, and she is a pastry chef. In fact, she is the James Beard Best Outstanding Pastry Chef for last year for Mindy's Hot Chocolate.
In Chicago, yeah.
In like Chicago. She's hot right now. Let's listen to Mindy Siegel.
Hey, wait till you hear about this dessert.
Oh, yes.
And by the time we got there, they'd sold out. Probably just as well for our waistlines.
Now, we're talking to somebody I wanted to talk to for a long time, Mindy Siegel. Hello. And I really don't know where you came from. All of a sudden, you were in my life. Tell me where you came from. You were a James Beard Award winner for pastry chef. I mean, you have your own restaurant. Tell us about all of this.
I've always liked to bake, so I've been baking for about 30 years. I've been working in great kitchens, primarily in Chicago, and I always wanted to have my own restaurant. And about 9 years ago, I opened my own restaurant, so I'm doing pretty well. And I'm a pastry chef, so there I am. I mean, there's really nothing to say. I love baking, I love cooking, and I love the industry. So that's where I am.
Why the name of your...
It's my name is crazy. I picked the name because I'm a pastry chef, and I wanted to have a name that would connotate a feeling, but I'm the only one that gets it. So now, 9 years later, I think most people get my restaurant. You're really sticking that in my face.
That's the only way we're going to be able to hear you.
I thought I was talking loud enough.
I keep thinking of the change that happened with Christina Tosi and this milk, cereal milk stuff. Did that change the whole arena for pastry chefs? Christina Tosi of Mama Fuca Milk.
Yeah, well, I don't think so. I mean, I know Christina, we're friends, but she has her own style. And I think that what makes this pastry culture so interesting is that we all are very different and we all have our own way of doing things.
And you're going to tell our listeners what your way of doing things is.
I like taking classic sort of pastry, no matter what it is, and I like to put my own little twist on it. And I try to make you think about it in a different way. If you go to my table tonight, I'm making all different cookies. And they're not cookies that you would see really anywhere else. They're cookies that I invented. And I think that not only is it like my craft to make a great chocolate chip cookie, but it's sort of my craft to come up with a different way to make a chocolate cookie that makes you think about a chocolate chip cookie differently. And that's how I interpret what I do. So I'm really into cookies. I make a lot of cookies, but I do make plated desserts and I make bread and I make everything.
I'm interested in your take on all this sugar and sugar substitute stuff, stevia and all this other stuff. I mean, most of it, I have to tell you, I've never liked any substitute for sugar, but I don't eat sugar that much anyhow, so I'm not an expert. You are an expert, so tell me.
Well, I'm not an expert on sugar substitute. Unfortunately, I haven't really worked a lot with any of the sugar substitutes. I'm interested in them, but I'm still perfecting my craft with sugar. So they're chemicals. They don't taste like sugar. I don't think they're sweet. I would rather eat fresh fruit and extract fresh fruit if that's something that people can eat, but I'm not really into the sugar substitutes at all.
Every year they predict new flavors that are going to be hot in desserts. And every year it seems to me it's salt and caramels. Is there anything else?
Well, yeah, there's fresh produce that are seasonal that tastes excellent. I'm really not into the trend is. I don't follow trends. I don't read things to make me think about what everybody else is doing. I sort of like to think that I'm doing my own thing and it's really good for me, and I stick with the things that I love, which is sugar and brown sugar and caramel and butterscotch and salt and fresh strawberries and great raspberries in September and bananas in the winter and golden pineapple when I can get golden pineapple. So I'm not really thinking about what the next thing that somebody else is coming up with.
You'd be doing your thing in Chicago. You almost never get a chef staying in place anymore, but I guess you almost never get a chef staying in place anymore, except that, I mean, a pastry chef pretty much has to, right?
Do you mean in the restaurant, that a pastry chef stays in the restaurant that they work in? I think there's so many different opportunities for pastry chefs and chefs. They don't have to work at a restaurant anymore. They can open up their own business. They can write books. They can consult. There's so many different avenues that chefs can do now. The possibilities are endless. So I don't think that you have to stay where you are or complacent. I think you should keep evolving and moving forward.
Well, a somewhat change of pace is I'm plunging into the deep south, Dallas to be example, to be specific. And I'm sure everybody who's followed the dining scene in Dallas knows about Stephen Piles. He's made his mark for sure, starting with Star Canyon. And, well, he has new restaurants now, and he has other ones coming up, and let's just talk to him. He's a delight. I really have a list of chefs that I want to interview, and you are on it. And how you eluded me all these 8 years, I have no idea. Stephen Piles, welcomed on the menu. You have so many restaurants. What I really want you to do, you native Texan, you, is bring us up to date on what you're running, what restaurants you've got, gotten out and the concept.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much, Ann, for finally having me on the air. We've got so many common friends. So I have five restaurants currently. I have the flagship called. I had to pick a name I wouldn't forget, so I picked the name Stephen Piles. I'm getting to that age, you know what I mean? So Stephen Piles is the flagship. Then I have a restaurant that's international small plates called Samar by Stephen Piles. It's Eastern Mediterranean, Spanish, and Indian. It's actually inspirations from those countries. So that's a very small little place. Then I have...
It sounds wonderful, though. Absolutely wonderful.
It really is. I was afforded 5 years of travel once I sold Star Canyon. I did very well, and so this is the reflection of those 5 years of travel. It was a lot of fun to put together. So then I have a restaurant in San Antonio called Sustainio, which is very nice. It's a license agreement, and it's kind of a reflection or kind of a replication, I guess, of flagship Stephen Piles, Southwestern, modern Southwestern cooking, I call it. And then I've opened the most fun is kind of like going home to my truck stop cafe, which my family had. It's called Stampede 66, and it's an homage to all things Texan. And then I just opened a little mini version of that at the regional airport. It's called Sky Canyon.
That's very ingenious, because everybody knows Star Canyon. That's amazing. Now, Dallas's restaurant scene, is it on the rise? Austin is seeming to exceed all the restaurant development in Dallas.
Well, it's interesting. Dallas certainly is on the slow rise. We've been at it longer. Austin is, that's a brand new pop. So they've got a long way to go, I think, to catch up with us. We have so much more depth, and we are, I think, a culinary capital in Texas. But we're slowly regaining the title, I think, of a restaurant town.
Just to titillate, I love that word, titillate, our listeners, they love to have food details. What are you serving tonight?
Serving two wonderful dishes. First of all, a dish from Stampede, which is my Texas restaurant. It's a crispy sweetbread taco with a little foie gras mousse. Foie gras is a false foie gras. And the most important thing is the tortillas are made from scratch. We make our own nixtamal. We grind our own corn. So the best corn tortilla you can have. So that's one dish. The other dish is a manchego chicharron. It's in quotes, of course, because it's not a real chicharron, but it's crispy like that. It's a crispy manchego cheese chicharron that has on top of it all things Texan, which is a Gulf Coast crab meat tossed with some Texas peaches.
I can't wait to try them. I can't believe my good luck in cornering you for this interview. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, Ann. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, I just wanted to mention a few of the others that we just couldn't quite get. Everyone was so busy. The people from Terra were there. Nancy Silverton had a wonderful bruschetta. I don't know how many of those I ate, but she was lined up and busy. Our friend Charlie Fan, who had the wonderful lettuce wraps. Who else was there?
Lydia Shire from Boston.
Lydia Shire from Boston.
Yeah, we've talked to her in the past. Mark Peel from Campanile in Los Angeles always comes.
Yeah. And so anyhow, Paul Prudhomme wasn't there, but he had his
gang was there.
His gang was there, right. Anyhow, just it was a great crowd.
I tell you, this party's coming up in 2015, in June of 2015. If you watch on the menu, we'll make sure you're informed about it. And make sure as well that you check. I think it's Five Star Sensation is the name of the website. Put a reminder in your calendar now. Tickets sell out early, so in the spring.
Yeah, and don those stilettos. Boy, were there gorgeous shoes
They all get dressed up, too. You didn't realize that Clevelanders get all dressed up. They do, too. Anyway, what are
time
we doing
now?
Oh, it's time for a break, and then after the break, we'll still be in a party frame of mind. We just won't be in Cleveland.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I'm sure that especially after you've heard our next guest, you'll agree with us and with many bartenders and many spirits consumers around the world that tequila is a party in a glass. And Lucinda, what's Lucinda's last name?
Lucinda Hudson, not only is she a party girl and knowing how to enjoy herself, but she could tell you exactly how to throw one great party. Listen to Lucinda. Now here is a book after my own heart, and possibly liver as well, called Viva Tequila. And its author
Lucinda Hudson. Pictures in the book, having a good time all the time. Welcome to On the Menu, Lucinda.
Hi.
You sure look like you know how to have a good time.
Oh, well, I hope so. Tequila makes me have a good time.
Listeners, this is a book with everything. This is a book that begins with the history of tequila and ends with how you recover from a tequila hangover.
And don't forget, it mentions pulque and mezcal, too.
Right. Now, you're going to explain that to us. Where would you like to start? How you present, like, the first chapter?
Well, I think what's so important in this book is that it's not just a drinking book, that it's a three-part book, so you learn all about the agave spirits, tequila, pulque, and mezcal, and the second part is the cantina, or the bar book, and the third part is the cocina, or the cookbook. So even if you're not a drinker, there are stories and history and anthropology and all sorts of culture and traditions found in this book.
Well, you have been at this for quite some time. This is actually a highly expanded, updated, and highly expanded version of a previous book. But you said in many ways it's a new book. Tell us about that.
It really is. I wrote the first book, which was called Tequila, Cooking with the Spirit of Mexico, in 1995, and it was so ahead of the time. It sold out of a couple printings, but, you know, tequila was just beginning to get really, really popular. And in this version, I just really wanted to tell more of the stories of what it's been like to be traveling for 30 years through Mexico, many of the times alone, as a woman and a young woman alone. So I really wanted to tell the stories that made the first book even come to life. So this one has just fun adventures. I call it agave adventures. And just really, really celebrating the wonderful spirits of Mexico.
Wow.
There are a lot of folk art pictures and documentary photos for 30 years of travel as well.
And I love your little, what do you call them, little boxes where you have cute little headings for what you're going to talk about. Like
the sidebars. I think that's really important, so that there are lots of little tidbits that are easy to find in the sidebars. And did you notice the dichos, or the proverbs, that the Mexican use a lot in drinking? So they're fun little proverbs throughout the book.
And like grasshoppers, if you eat them, you return to Oaxaca.
Mezcal,
if you drink it, you will return to Oaxaca.
Yes. You know, in Oaxaca, ground grasshoppers are used in a salt mixture for drinks, and they're also nibbled upon. Tiny little chili-flavored grasshoppers that are fried, and they're really tasty tidbits, especially if you sprinkle them over guacamole and warm tortillas and sip a little bit of mezcal. That'll scare anybody, won't it?
Yeah, well, you could eat a lot of things if you chase them down with the mezcal, I guess.
Well, you know, some people think that mezcal always has to have a worm in the bottle, in the bottom of the bottle, and a lot of people thought tequila had the worm, too. But most of the finer mezcals would not think of putting a worm in a bottle of mezcal, and others are feeling like it's in the bottle for a purpose, to give flavor and to show that it's an agave spirit, and some even think it has spiritual connotations.
And which of those things are true?
Maybe all three, and by the time you get to the bottom of the mezcal, if you're the lucky one to drink it down, you won't know the difference.
Now let's start back at the beginning. Why were you in Mexico at such an early stage of your life?
Well, I grew up in El Paso on the border, so I spoke Spanish fluently, and I started traveling with my dad fishing throughout Baja at a young age, and I just loved Mexico so much that as soon as I graduated college after living in Europe, I just started traveling Mexico. And I'd studied anthropology at the University of Texas. And one of my projects was the medicinal herbs used by Mexican women. Well, once I started interviewing them, I ended up in the kitchens, and then it was all over. You know, I was more interested in food and drink than medicine.
Well, now, tell us, the mother plant is the blue agave?
The mother plant for tequila, well, All these Mexican agave spirits that I talk about come from agave plants, but there are hundreds of agave plants. So tequila can only come by law from one, the blue agave. So there's only one agave that can be used to produce tequila. And tequila's sister drink would be mezcal, and that can come from about 28 varieties of agave. And then pulque, the first agave drink that the Aztecs began to imbibe, it's only a fermented drink, not a distilled drink. And it comes from another, say, 6 or 7 major types of agaves. So you see how the people have been using these agaves for centuries for different types of drinks.
But they look basic. They look like great big cactuses, right?
Well, they're not a cactus. They're really more akin to a lily. And the fun thing about making mezcal or tequila, the mother agave plant, it takes almost 10 years for it to mature. Think of grapes and grain that take 1 year. The agave plant takes 10 years. And I kind of liken it to an artichoke. It's a big old plant, 6 feet tall. But think of a big artichoke. You have to whack away those outer leaves. And what's in the center, the heart of the plant, looks like a huge pineapple. And in fact, it's called a piña and can weigh over 100 pounds. So if you cut that in half, it would be white, like a turnip inside, and caustic and a starch. And that has to be baked in an oven, and when it comes out of these ovens, it looks like a sweet potato drenched in honey. And that is the fermentable product that will then be distilled. It's amazing. Like chocolate or like vanilla. Who would ever think that these bitter, raw ingredients would turn into a sumptuous treat?
Now, you said it was not a cactus. It was related to what?
To a lily.
Oh, that's right, a lily.
I call it the lily of the field. But not a cactus.
Right.
You've got a wonderful section on all kinds of concoctions, all kinds of drinking concoctions made with tequila. Tell us about some of those. I mean, some of them really sound wonderful.
Well, again, what I'm wanting to do more in my book is to preserve culture and traditions. You know, tequila has become the darling of mixologists. And in my opinion, oftentimes they're mixing so many other liqueurs and agave syrup and bitters and foams and this and that I'm kind of screaming, where's the tequila? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to preserve more of the real traditional ways in which Mexicans love their tequila, which can include just sipping and savoring it neat, not chugging it down in shots. They do beautiful punches, fresh fruit punches. That are spiked with tequila, but all sorts of tropical fruits in them. They do, of course, the margarita is so famous, but there are a lot of fun spritzers. For instance, this one sounds crazy, and it's so delicious. Fresh squeezed orange juice, lime juice, a good shot of silver or reposado tequila, some hot chili sauce, and then you add a splash of beer, which gives it just a little bit of fizz, and some chopped red onion and some chopped serrano. Move over Bloody Mary. Move over Mimosa. It's the most refreshing. That beer, just a little bit of fizz, brings the drink up and gives it some sparkle. And it's loved on all the ranches in Mexico during the fiestas.
Wow.
But I read, interestingly enough, that there is one gentleman who's actually making tequila and storing it and aging it in used whiskey barrels, used Scotch whiskey barrels.
Yeah, that's how tequila is aged, usually in oak barrels. And some producers are experimenting with port and wine barrels to give tequila, and Scotch barrels even, to give the aged tequila the nuances more towards the fine brown spirits like cognac or, cognac, brandy, port, things like that. What I think is very interesting about tequila that many people don't realize, there are four very different spirits almost that come from the same plant. So when tequila comes out of the still, it's the blanco or the silver tequila. And then if it ages for 2 months to a year in oak, we get the lovely Reposo or Reposado tequila. And then if the tequila ages longer, for up to 3 years, we get the Añejo or the aged tequila. And then over 3 years, we get the extra Añejo. So, you know, you're getting four almost different spirits from the same still.
Wow, it's amazing, huh? Now, I mean, if somebody just came up and asked you to describe what tequila tastes like, what would you tell them?
Ooh, well, at first I'd say it depends on the tequila.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Because, of course, you can get fiery, petrol-y, I guess you want to check it down, but a fine tequila, fine silver tequila will have flavors of citrus and fresh herbs. And the flavor of the agave is hard to describe because we know what grapes taste like. You know, who knows what the agave tastes like? Once it's baked, it's sweet potatoes and yams baked in a clay pot with floral honey. It's just exquisite. And it should be sipped and savored, as the Mexicans do.
Now, you suggest keeping it in the freezer, like we keep our vodka.
Well, now, many tequila aficionados would probably want to disagree with that, but I live in Texas, and I'll tell you, there is nothing like bringing an ice-cold bottle of silver tequila out of the freezer, and I take it a step farther, and I freeze the bottle in a block of ice, with cactus. Okay, I use plastic cactus from floral supplies, but within the ice, they look so real. People wonder how I freeze cactus.
Oh,
but I bring this wonderful thing out and pour shots at you know, parties, and I have a centerpiece, and it's delicious.
Yeah, you're big into parties and music as well, huh?
Yes, and throughout the book, I give a lot of suggestions for music and, you know, songs to request to mariachis and give a lot of festive ideas for entertaining. And the third part of the book, which is the food part of the book, all the recipes are kind of geared towards festive, fiesta, entertaining, and buffet-type foods and just fun, colorful, lively recipes.
Now tell us the story about the conejos.
Oh, the 400 drunken rabbits.
I love that story.
Isn't that a fun story? There's just so much mythology surrounding this. Some say the Virgin Mary was, the Catholic Virgin Mary was easily assimilated into the Indian rituals, and she became Mayahuel, or the goddess. The Aztecs had, of course, worshipped her, and she was a deity with 400 breasts who fed 400 rabbits. And each one of those rabbits was a type of inebriation. And, you know, so that'd be the playful one, the drunk one, the this, the that. So there's a lot of mythology surrounding tequila and drinking in Mexico.
Right. Now, do you still travel to Mexico a lot?
I must say, in the last few years, I haven't been, mainly because I've been working. You know, I did, as I said, lots of the design and photographs and worked so hard on that part of the book as well as the writing. So I've been kind of stuck at home for a while. I know we're all a little bit nervous about traveling in Mexico right now, but it's such a warm and engaging country, and I just think if you treat the people wonderfully, hopefully you'll be treated that way in return. I mean, I traveled throughout this country by myself on buses and had nothing but incredible experiences with wonderful people.
Well, I hope that the customs are not lost in the contemporary confusion.
Well, they are, and, you know, that's what's breaking my heart, and that's why in this book, I'm really preserving the drinks, the fun dichos, the proverbs, the toasts, the art, because it is rapidly disappearing. For instance, I have a drink in the book that is one of my favorites. It's called Sangrita, which means little blood. It's a bright red drink.
I love and that nowadays, with tequila. Is that not
right?
Loud?
What you do, it's non-alcoholic. the quintessential chaser because it's sweet, sour, salty. What are the other taste buds? It hits them all, piquant. And so it's a non-alcoholic chaser, and you pour that in a shot glass, and you accompany it with a shot of silver or reposado tequila. Now, if you're in Mexico, in Jalisco, and order a shot of tequila, it just comes to the table anyway. But nowadays, down there, they're kind of doing a Bloody Mary mix, you know, and giving it to you.
Oh, no.
Whereas my drink dates back for hundreds of years, and it's fresh orange juice, lime juice, pomegranate juice, hot chili sauce, and salt, a little bit of salt. And it is so refreshing and delicious. And you sip that with the tequila.
Exactly. I can remember the barman at the American Airlines Club in Mexico City airport used to make me sangritas.
Yes.
Before breakfast, before getting on the plane to come home from Mexico to the United States.
It's delicious.
Yeah.
I think you...
Now, I did take it a step, and I must say, based on tradition, I came up with two other sangritas, which I shouldn't call sangrita because, as I said, that means blood, but I do a mango, chili, ginger, cilantro one that is so bright yellow and delicious as a chaser, and I also do a green one with mint and cilantro and tomatillos, and so I do my trio of these sangritas, and they're so refreshing and so delicious.
I think
and colorful.
I think you're inventing Mexico in Austin, Texas.
Peter, I have Mexico a cantina on my backyard, and it is pretty precious. It's a real Mexico. It looks like you're in Mexico.
we'll come by and see for ourselves.
You better. I mean, I really do. It has turquoise walls and these wonderful mariachis that are carved out of old oil drums that the Mexicans make, and they look so real. They even have on huaraches, and they're playing. There's a photo of that in the book.
Well, listen.
In the cantina chapter, right at the beginning of the cantina chapter, there's a photo. And see, that's what I want to do is encourage people to have their own cantinas at home, even if it's a little shelf in your living room. It's the cantina spirit. It's welcoming people lovingly into your home, sharing wonderful drinks and food with them, making toast to them and welcoming them. That's the Mexican spirit.
Well, we're an hour closer to tequila time than you are.
What are you going to have?
And we have the advantage of your wonderful book, Viva Tequila. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, you all are wonderful. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Come to Austin, okay?
Yeah, we will.
Good. Come to my cantina.
Thanks, Lucinda.
Thank you all so much. Good cheer.
Cheer.
It's time to take a break, so we'll do that now, but we'll come back right after the break with more about tequila. Although it's a play on words rather than more about the subject itself.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
For our last segment today, we have a combination of a book about cocktails and wonderful play on words.
Yeah, it's Tim Federle is the author, and the book is called Tequila Mockingbird. And in the press release, he says it's like the Spark Notes with a liquor license.
so you better listen to this one.
The Picture of Dorian Gray, the last of the movie. I howled my way through this.
Yeah, I told him that
the deviled egg wears Prada.
I told him the next time he should do it with spoonerisms. Anyway, here's Tim.
I have to admit that when my good buddy, Ron, the publicist, sent me this book, I thought, you've lost it, Ron. You've really lost it. It was entitled, of course, Tequila Mockingbird. And I thought, oh, God, he's lost it. And then I started reading it, Cocktails with a Literary Twist, and I couldn't stop laughing. So I was delighted that the author, Tim Federle, could actually come and talk to us about what motivated this madness, Tim.
Yes, that's right. What motivated the madness? I think what motivated the madness for this cocktail recipe book was that I love classic literature, and I love a good cocktail, and I thought it would be really funny to combine two of my favorite activities. So Tequila Mockingbird, Cocktails with a Literary Twist, is kind of my tribute to English majors everywhere.
Yeah, well, here's what, the rye and the catcher.
The rye and the catcher. Oh, yes. Yeah, it's full of potentially groan-worthy puns. But, yeah, a couple of my favorite. I love Bridget Jones's Daiquiri.
Last of the Mojitos.
The Last of the Mojitos is a sentimental favorite. Yes, that is a very a delicious mojito recipe with I send up the book.
Well, if you were going to have a one-sentence or two-sentence description of this book that if you were sending it to a publisher for consideration, how would you describe it?
I would say that Tequila Mockingbird, Cocktails with a Literary Twist, is the ultimate cocktail recipe guide for recovering English majors. That's probably...
Aren't you a little bit worried some of the authors who are still living might actually take offense?
Well, I think it's all done lovingly. There's one in there, Judy Blume, who our beloved Judy Blume. I would say the most popular recipe based on fan readership, because I've been hearing from people, is probably It's Me, Margarita.
Yes, I love that.
And the whole idea is about levity. It's about taking something that can be traditionally a little bit stuffy, which is these giant books. There, God, It's Me, Margaret, of course, is more of a contemporary classic. But yeah, it's taking these kind of, gosh, these old-fashioned books that so many of us kind of had to suffer our way through in college. And it's saying, look, you can twist it and bring some levity to it. And in each recipe, there's, I think, 65 cocktail recipes. In each recipe, I kind of do a description of the original book, and then I tie it to a classic cocktail.
We know the aforementioned publicist, my buddy Ron, when he sent the announcement, he said, congrats, you fought through War and Peace, burned through Fahrenheit 451, and sailed through Moby Dick. Okay, you nearly drowned in Moby Dick, but you made it safely back to shore and are in need of a cocktail. That's how he opens his press release for this book.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea here is for all of these drinks, I mean, a drink like Infinite Zest, which is a takeoff on Infinite Jest, which right. is one of the heaviest books in every sense of the word, uh-huh. including if you put it on a scale. So the idea with Infinite Zest, which is like a lemon drop martini, is take something that maybe you've never heard of. I also, you know, my other idea for this book was it's the type of book you might get at Urban Outfitters. It's kind of like a little gentleman's cocktail book, and the design of it has, it's very old-fashioned, and there are these
It's a really nice size, and it's the illustrations. Tell us about the illustrator, because she's fabulous.
She is fabulous. Her name is Lauren Mortimer, and she's British, and she's young and beautiful and fantastic, and they gave her this assignment. And what she did is she took these drink recipes, so one of them is Romeo and Julep, which is like a mint julep, and she took that and she drew a fantastic old-fashioned, everything is very hand-drawn, and she drew these two young lovers sprawled all over the floor with a drink in their hand. So she's incredibly, incredibly creative.
She got the whole idea of the book, too.
She really got it, yes, she really
Orange
got it.
Orange Julius Caesar is wearing a toga. Really funny, the glasses that don't go on.
Now, we should have mentioned starting out here that you're a literary person and you've obviously read a lot of books, otherwise you wouldn't have the raw material to come up with these fascinating tweaks of the titles or the characters. You also have another profession altogether.
Well, yeah, I do. I'm a novelist as well. Of course, I've written a novel for kids. And so my idea was that I needed to write a book for their parents as well, so Tequila Mockingbird comes in. But I also, my former life is as a professional dancer, and so I had a whole life on Broadway dancing in shows, and And there's no industry that's more fueled by cocktails than showbiz.
So we should expect at some point you're going to appear on Dancing with the Stars, or at least you'll make a cocktail.
Yeah, there might be exactly at the bars.
Okay, can you do a quick pun on Dancing with the Stars, but you already did.
Yeah, I mean, there'd be so much that we could be here all day. Or maybe I would do a snack, an actual food thing, and I would do something with salsa, and I'd do a takeoff on the dance salsa. Because there are also bar bites.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell us about you include food in your bar bites.
I wanted to also do some snacks in the book. So in addition to all the cocktails, there are bar bites for book hounds. So there's the Double Bag Wears Prada, Harry Potter, Don Quixote is one of my favorites. So these are just easy snacks that you can make at home that, similarly to the cocktails, they tie into a popular or enduring novel that I like to take the air out of a little bit and twist it with something totally different.
Well, you're in L.A., and you're obviously on a book tour, are you now?
Yes, I am. I'm out for the L.A. Times Festival of Books, and then I'll be in Dallas with Tequila Mockingbird as well.
Lots of luck.
What's your step? Don't go to Boston anytime soon.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so terrible.
But tell me this, how is the book being received?
I think very well. It's brand new. We got a fantastic rave review in the Evening Standard, one of London's big papers. And there's just been lots of chatter about the book online. Tequila Mockingbird. I'm not the first person to come up with this pun by any means. Uh-huh. But so I'm not that guilty of all of this groaning. But it was really fun to create, to make something out of it. And I've met so many librarians and educators in the last year when I was on tour with my novel for kids, which is called Better Nate Than Ever, and which is about a Pittsburgh area kid, actually. And I've met so many librarians, and a lot of them have just been having giggle fits when they pick up the book and start flipping through it. It really is a book that I hope book clubs, because I have some recipes in here for book clubs. So there's Gone with the Wine, The Picture of Dorian Gray Goose.
I love that one, The Picture of Dorian Gray Goose.
That's a really fun one. So it's a vodka-based sort of rejuvenating tonic for anyone who doesn't want to age like Dorian Gray. I'm hoping book clubs find their way to this book. And then there's also drinks for what I like to say recovering readers. So there's non-alcoholic drinks as well that are a bit on the gentler side.
Now, you took a big risk, I think, because your parts 2 and 3 of the book are clearly sexist. You have drinks for gals and drinks for guys. Now, how did you decide which ones fit into which category?
It's a very good question. I think for most of them, I chose it based on the protagonist, not the drink, because we live in a society now where even guys drink Cosmos. So it was more like for...
I don't know any guy who drinks a Cosmo.
Oh, come on, Ann. You gotta come visit New York sometime. Get out of the house. The drinks for dames is Gin Air because of Jane Eyre.
Oh, right.
Or Bridget Jones's Daiquiri for Bridget Jones. And then for the gulps for guys, it's like every other drink seems to be tied to some seafaring, you know, there's Gulpiverse Travels, Moby Drink, the Lime of the Ancient Mariner. So yes, Peter, you're absolutely right. I wanted to divide the book in some way, and I thought one way to do that would be to focus on books that were traditionally associated with a male or female protagonist.
Now, where did you put Silas Marnier then? I can't remember. I saw it. after all, the author was really a woman, but she wrote under a man's name. So where did she fit?
That's right, and she fit under the gentleman's drinks, but I'll read a little bit. So Silas Marnier by George Eliot, and I've written, this is a sample, it says, "Dude writes like a lady, penned under the name George Eliot, Marianne Evans, Silas Marnier is the tale of a man wronged by his church, closely mirroring the author's own disenchantment with religion. It's only after Marner loses his gold fortune, only after he's forced to leave town under false accusations of stealing from his congregation's coffers, that he discovers his true idea of wealth, becoming a father. Hailed as a clever critique of organized worship and industrialized England, Silas Marner inspires a drink that's a little bit bitter and a little gold-flecked, sort of like a man's own life." And then I've got something with Goldschlager and Grand Marnier and ginger ale and bitters. And so it's a drink that kind of allows you to sit back and reflect on the fine.
That's really so scholarly, it's really hard to believe.
You have a lot of different activities, so we'll be sure to mention your website, timfederle.com.
Yes, that's right.
And you list all the things you're doing, your activities, what's coming up next, how to get your books, and where you're going to be.
I do.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, I do, because we live in this time when everybody likes to know where you are at all times, whether you want it or not. So there are news and appearances section in my website, and you can see where I'll be next.
Did you say nudes and appearances?
Yes, that's right.
How cute.
Now, I want you to know that the idea I gave you before we came on the air, which is that you should do a sequel based on spoonerisms.
Which nobody will understand because they're not English.
I like that though, Peter, because the book Tequila Mockingbird's on sale in London, so we could do something for our British, and we could do spoonerisms, and it could be all dishes that are eaten with spoons.
Just remember that when you do that, you owe me a commission, I think.
I think a credit ought to suffice.
Only a credit? Yeah. I only get a credit?
Really,
much success with this book, and I think it's the kind of book that you're going to want to gobble up a bunch of copies and give them to your friends. It is a very, very clever and thoughtful present.
And since Jonathan Winters just passed away, you could undoubtedly take on a larger role in society.
Well, Peter and Anne, thank you so much for having me on today.
Uh-huh. We enjoyed talking to you so much, and we're giggling over the book.
I'm so glad. Thank you so much.
Ciao, Tim. Bye.
Take care.
And the editor sighs with relief as the program is concluding. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week, and we'll have more excitement about the wonderful world of food, wine, and travel.
Until then, bye-bye.